Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Monday, June 13th. This is episode 17. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good evening, Scott.
Howdy.
Happy WWDC Day.
Keynote Day.
Keynote Day. Did you watch the whole thing?
I started watching it with the intent of watching the whole thing, and it was too distracting, and it was, I could tell it was going to be a long one.
It was.
Yeah.
It's over 2 hours, right?
So I made it for like the first maybe 45, 50 minutes, and I had to concentrate on what I should have been doing at the time.
Yeah. Well, I caught the end. I was spending time with people who do not appreciate both an Apple keynote event nor the fiddling with one's phone during lunchtime. So I missed the beginning, but I will come back and watch it, the whole thing, in a couple of days, I'm sure.
Yep, same here.
I did read about it, though. What are your thoughts? Do you have a favorite thing? Let's start with Mac OS. So, OS 10, or OS X, as it's commonly mispronounced.
Yeah.
Is dead.
I have to be honest, I've done that from time to time. It's one of those where you hear it wrong too many times, and then you think about how to say it right, and I don't know. I have other things like that, too, where it ends up convoluted in my head, and I ultimately end up saying it wrong. Because you hear it wrong so many times.
So does that mean Mac OS is a better title in your mind?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, Roman numerals in general, in something that you're going to say verbally, is problematic.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We don't need to relive John Gruber's Roman numeral diatribe, but I know that lowercase m matches everything else. You know, watchOS, tvOS, iOS.
Except Mac is a proper noun.
Yeah.
The other things aren't.
I feel like the M should be capitalized, but obviously.
It looks kind of funny at first glance because you've never seen Mac before without a capital M.
It looks misspelled.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's always going to look misspelled, but.
Because now that it's Mac OS little m, then why isn't it MacBook little m?
Yeah.
Are they going to do that next? I mean, are they drawing a line in the sand that, like, the Mac prefix now starts with a lowercase? No, probably not. So now there's inconsistency, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're recording this on a MacBook Pro, and the M is capitalized, right? I can see it right at the bottom of my screen.
Mm.
So, yeah. But Sierra, that's what it's called. That's the next one, right?
Yes. So is that another...
I don't know.
Is it a national park or a feature or something?
Probably.
Okay.
It's probably a mountain range somewhere. So, yeah.
I feel like they introduced a lot of useful stuff. Like a lot of features. Lots of times when Apple introduces new OS features, I'm like, that's novel, that's interesting, but I will never use it. And there were several things that popped up today that I actually think I might use. I thought the improvements to messaging were really cool. I guess that crosses over to iOS as well, but I've been doing more messaging on my laptop.
Yeah.
And I feel like it feels kind of constrained, and some of the enhancements to that looked pretty cool. I thought the tabbed interface thing was interesting. Did you see that?
Mm-mm.
So basically you can take any program and you can establish a window and then add a running instance of it as a tab. So it's basically, it's kind of like Spaces. I don't know if you ever use Spaces. I never found that to be particularly useful. Like, I didn't like the context switching. But the idea of, you know, I have two different things that I'm doing on the computer right now, and each of them use multiple programs, to be able to slam those into a single window and then minimize, maximize it, and then just switch between tabs is interesting to me.
Okay. I'll have to seek that out. That's what I use Spaces for, right? So, you know, number two on this laptop is where email and Slack live, right? On my main machine, I often have four, you know. There's one where I'm writing code, and there's one for, you know, chat and email and stuff, and then there's maybe another one for goofing off or whatever, and then another one for a testing window or something. I mean, I don't know. I have, for a long time, naturally organized my tasks, you know, in Spaces, but that's just me.
Yeah, and for some reason that concept has never really worked for me. I don't know. There's something about feeling like you're in different desktops that I just never really got into. But this idea that it's just different windows that are all present at the same time is interesting to me. I mean, I like tabbed console,
yeah.
You know, a tabbed interface with multiple console windows, a tabbed interface with multiple browser windows.
Yeah.
Like, that concept works for me. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
It was cool that it's just going to be supportable out of the box for any application. Like, there's no enabling that anybody has to do to make it work.
So I saw a bunch of the messaging improvements when they were talking about it on iOS, right? With the invisible ink and the saying it softly, saying it loud, the whole screen animation thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that stuff coming to macOS too?
Yes. And then like the embeds, embedding videos and links and images, stuff like that.
The rich linking like Slack has is good.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I'm always disappointed when it doesn't work in Slack. And incorrectly, I probably blame Slack every time it does that, right? You drop the link in there, and then you're waiting, and it doesn't change. And I always say, you know, come on, Slack, why can't you do that? And I'm sure it's not Slack's fault. I'm sure the wherever I've linked to is being unhelpful here. Slack takes the brunt of the blame. Sorry.
Siri on the desktop is not particularly interesting to me because I don't find Siri to be particularly useful.
I think Siri on the desktop is going to be more useful to me.
If I thought Siri were more useful, I would probably use it on the desktop. But how so?
I'm often alone in front of the computer, and I think I'm more likely to talk to her.
I feel like on the phone, what Siri is getting you is a replacement for typing. And when I'm sitting in a computer, I have no problem with typing. I type fast.
I am not
faster than Siri can process my words.
I feel like I'll use Siri to deal with interruptions without having to stop working on what I'm working on. Probably. I don't know. I'll have to see. The people who know me well and are listening are saying, of course, it doesn't matter what you say, Matt, because you won't have Siri on your desktop for a year. So so why are you even worried about it? But
so no feature? You didn't see any feature that will cause you to upgrade day one or even the .1 release?
It's not in my nature to upgrade to any of Apple's .0 or .1s. even not twos, really. I came to El Capitan at dot four. So, we'll see. I usually upgrade iOS sooner, but I don't know.
The Apple Music, or not Apple Music, that's a whole other debacle, but Apple Pay in the browser.
That's going to be awesome.
That's interesting to me. I have to be honest, it would have been more interesting to me before I discovered 1Password for storing my credit cards.
Ah.
So, you know, I didn't do that until pretty recently. And then I was always like, why can't I just use Apple Pay, you know, in the browser, especially on the phone? To me, it's bizarre that when I'm browsing on the phone and I buy something and I need to pay for it in mobile Safari, that I can't do it with Apple Pay. That's where I think it's going to be a really big deal. On the desktop, it's cool, but I feel like for me, that need is already met with autofill of credit cards from 1Password.
For me, the thing I'm looking for is, I know for a fact that it's going to be, you know, tokenized payment processing, right? There are some online retailers that I'm intimately familiar with, and I know that they do tokenization on their end. But there are a lot of them that I'm sure don't, and they probably, you know, just write my damn credit card number into a database, and I have to hope that they don't get hacked. And, you know, on a long enough timeline, everybody's going to get hacked.
Right.
So, the thing I like about something like Apple Pay is I know that my data doesn't travel any farther than it has already traveled, right? I already have a credit card in my Apple Pay, and I know that the vendor won't get it.
That's true. 1Password is only getting you convenience.
Yes.
Apple Pay is getting you the security.
Right.
That is cool.
I don't know how well it'll be implemented. I kind of use PayPal for that purpose now, right? Whenever I've decided I'm going to order something from some website that isn't a website that I normally do business with, like Amazon or something like that, I'm like, well, hopefully they accept PayPal and I can just use PayPal as my tokenization process. But PayPal has got its own set of frustrations.
Yeah.
So yeah, Apple Pay is a good thing.
The problem with it is it has to be enabled by developers.
Yep.
So every website is going to have to make a change to allow Apple Pay.
Well, so the big sites probably will, as a way to reduce friction. And I'm sure Apple will help them do it. And all the various CMS systems and shopping cart systems out there on the web will eventually incorporate it, and then all of the smaller shops will get that by default, right? Assuming their
right.
payment processor does it. I think it's a big win. So I'm looking forward to that.
That'll be the first time I've used this concept of, you know, I'm holding my phone in my hand and doing something that then is, you know, causing a change to happen on my computer.
Oh, you've not used any of the continuity features?
No, not really. I guess some of the sharing of, like, browser websites. I like that, how it automatically pops up in Safari. I'm not clear. Did you read this, the proximity, the auto unlock, of like proximity of your Apple Watch will unlock your computer? I read somewhere that it works with the phone too. And then I read somewhere else that it didn't. Do you remember?
I don't recall what they said exactly. It wouldn't surprise me if it works on new enough phones.
Yeah. That's a feature I would enable and find interesting.
Why?
Because I always have my phone in my pocket, and
You just tired of typing your password?
I walk away from my computer. It's a kind of a home office thing. I work from home, and so there aren't a lot of times that my computer really needs to be locked, but I like to leave a pretty short timeout, you know.
Yep.
Just for security purposes when I'm outside of my house. So then I come up and I eat lunch and I go back to my office and my computer is locked. Well, my phone was in my pocket, it would just come back to life.
I obsessively lock my computer. Hmm. When I'm alone in my house and I'm getting up to go into the kitchen and refill my glass of water, I will often, out of habit, lock the screen when I walk away. Just too many hours spent in computer labs using shared computers, I guess.
I've gotten out of the habit. So when I was in an office scenario, I walked away with it unlocked and I had this momentary panic. I was like, oh, you don't do that when you're in a big office building, do you?
Nope.
Run back and lock it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
that would be interesting to me.
Yeah. They did not announce any new watch hardware. You think they would do that in the fall with the iPhone introduction? I mean, there's got to be new watch hardware somewhere.
I guess. I feel like the watchOS version 3 improvements seem kind of lackluster. But I've resigned myself to the fact that I won't be getting an Apple Watch for a long time. Because I feel like in my head it has to meet a certain feature threshold. And for me, one of those is a week of battery life. And I don't know if it'll ever have that. If it does, it'll be version 5, you know?
Well, I think the next threshold is I'm gone for the weekend. That's the type of battery life it needs. So it's probably 3 days of battery life. I don't know when they're going to hit that. I would like to think it's the next version of the hardware. We'll see.
Yeah. My other threshold is the watch has to be sufficiently useful without the presence of the phone. And my definition of sufficiently useful is GPS features. So it has to have a GPS radio in the watch. And I don't know if they'll ever do that. We've talked about that before. They have an incentive to want you to have your phone on you at all times. So I don't feel Apple has an incentive to give you usefulness in the watch without the presence of the phone.
Well, so the GPS for mapping, your run or something like that, is probably pretty power intensive, but there are watches that are not smartwatches like the Apple Watches that have GPS radios built into them. I mean, there are some fitness watches that do.
My Vivo Active has a GPS radio in it.
Yeah. I know that Seiko makes a line of watches called the Astrom watches, and they are GPS watches, but they use GPS to know what time it is. And so it will set its own time based on GPS. And so if you got on a plane and flew out to New York and got off the plane, and
it would constantly be the correct time.
There's a couple of buttons you have to hit, but when you got outside of the airport and you had a good visibility of the sky, you could hit the buttons and the dials would go and it would find, you know, 4 or more GPS satellites and be like, oh, you're now in the Eastern time zone, and it would set the time correctly. And those watches are, I think a lot of them are actually solar powered, which means the face has a solar panel in it, and they're storing that in a battery that's driving the whole mechanism. They supposedly have about a month worth, if it's fully charged, they have about a month of charge time. So it's possible that the power budget for GPS is getting better and better. So maybe that could be the case one day. But I don't know. In my mind, it's still too thick and it's very square. I own many watches and have owned many watches in my life, and none of them have been square. I have a hard time with square watches.
Yeah.
But hey, that's just me.
I want an Apple Watch. I like the look of it, and
it's distinctive. I see them all over the place. Yes.
And I think they look attractive on people that I see them on.
Maybe there's a beauty test when you buy one.
Yeah, it wouldn't look attractive on me.
You're ugly. You can't have it.
That's why they make you go in the store to
shop
for it.
Yeah. That's probably true. So what else did they talk about? Right?
So I'll be interested to see. You know, I didn't catch a lot of what they update with Apple Music. I'm a pretty heavy Apple Music user on my phone, and it's a pretty bad experience. And they're on the second iteration right now. And they fixed quite a few of the things that were really weird. I've mentioned that before. Like, they had a really weird concept of storing music on your device. Only the option was called, like, save for offline or something like that. I don't know. It was really weird. Like, it didn't make sense that you were downloading the music to your phone. And so they've improved some of that. But there's a lot of weird little things in the navigation of it. Like when you're playing an album and you come out to do a search, there's no real good way to get back to the album that's playing in the album view. Like, you can get to the, like, what's up next view. But it's really convoluted. Navigation in the app right now is very convoluted. So I hope that's something they're fixing.
So I am not an Apple Music subscriber, but I have a bunch of music synced from my iTunes account onto my phone. And I agree that just trying to play music on the phone, that UI is stupidly complicated. Like, you remember when iPods had a little click wheel and it was easy? I feel like all of that's gone away. Like, there's so much stuff going on there that it's a lot of work to make it happen. And I don't like it. Maybe I should try to have Siri do this stuff for me. Right.
That's possible. Yeah. If there can be some managing of music with Siri.
Yeah. Like, Siri, play Band of Skulls for me or something. Right.
Yeah. I do a little bit of that. You have to be pretty precise with song titles.
So in the keynote today, when they were talking about the Siri API, they went out of their way to point out, with that WeChat example, all the different ways that you could tell Siri to use WeChat and say that I'm going to be 15 minutes late, which almost seemed like, you know, I'm sticking a sharp stick right in Amazon Echo's eye.
Yeah.
If that's really the case, that's awesome.
I hope it isn't just for that sending a message feature, because I have a couple, you know, I've started to try and use Siri more, and I've had a couple things, like, once I said, call mom and dad home, because that's a contact in my phone.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't do it. It wouldn't do it. And I was like, what's going on? Well, then I went in and looked, and actually I have it as dad and mom home.
Oh.
Well, if Google designed it, it probably would be able to say either side of the and.
Yeah.
Flip them and it's the same contact. I don't know. That one is a little sketchy. For the Apple Music, I said, I can't remember what it was. I said, I think I said, play You'll Be Back from Hamilton. And she's like, can't do it.
Yeah. Because you don't have a song titled You'll Be Back from Hamilton.
Exactly. And then I said, oh, okay, play You'll Be Back. And it played it. Well, she should recognize that, you know, the keyword from in a play music reference is potentially separating, you know, a song title from an album title.
That stuff is hard.
I know, but I guess maybe those are two hard examples. But I feel like other people in the voice recognition space are putting forth much greater effort to handle natural language.
Well, the demo Apple did today had a lot more of that.
I think my second case there, if they carry out the philosophy that they had in the demo you're talking about, if they carry that to playing music, it should be able to handle such and such from such and such and just deal with the fact that I said the song on the album.
Now, they did say, I guess I don't know about Siri, but a lot of the stuff that they are talking about is, in order to protect your privacy, they're doing that stuff on the device. Phone. Yeah. So, you know, in iOS 10, I think you're going to need an iPhone 5 or later to make it go. But
I appreciate the secureness of it, but I think that's going to continue to hamstring them compared to Amazon, you know, is doing everything in the cloud.
Well, it's not clear to me that it's going to hamstring them other than the fact that Amazon doesn't have to get you to install anything. Right? Amazon and Google, you know, doing that stuff in the cloud, they just put that stuff out on their production servers and then all the queries can use the new code. Right. If Apple's going to tie stuff to OS releases, it means that they're going to, you know, where Google and Amazon might have a more of a linear improvement, Apple's going to be in, you know, stair-step chunks. The upside is Apple does a pretty good job at getting people to update their phones.
Right. This is a pretty big step as far as stair steps go. I mean, this is the first legitimate update to Siri, isn't it, since its release?
It's a major update, though my guess would be if we were talking to some Siri engineers and we had enough beer in them that they were willing to talk about it, they would probably, you know, say, oh, we're on version 47 right. or something, you know, on the server. I'm sure they've been working on that thing nonstop for the 5 years that Siri has been in existence. So,
but nothing outward-facing that has been true innovation in Siri that I can remember. The stuff on TV, so it's interesting how it's kind of splintered. Like, the contextual stuff works much better on tvOS.
Yeah, but it's a narrow domain.
Right.
Right, it's just movie and television titles. Yeah. Like, I don't even think you can use Siri to play music on TV.
No, but I think you could argue that playing music is another narrow domain that they should have implemented, just like, you know, sending messages is a pretty narrow domain that they've obviously implemented now. So,
anyway, the Siri enhancements are exciting. I'm looking forward to them. I'm looking forward to see what other people can do with them. So, that'll be good. What else? Anything?
Nothing else really grabbed me. Well, we just saw, you know, they didn't mention it during the keynote today, but the new file system.
Oh, yeah, that was, that's at the top of Hacker News right now. APFS. So, HFS Plus, you know, has entered the final round, right?
Yeah.
Which is good. I'm ready for it to go. I am a hobby photographer, and I store a lot of photos on my Mac. And I have to do things to try to combat bit rot on my file systems so that I don't lose photos, right, as they age and bit rot and then become inaccessible. So, I just did a full clone of my iMac a couple weeks ago, and doing that takes more time than the average person is willing to do, simply because I have to take the time and calculate checksums, hashes of all of the picture files stored on my computer, and then diff those to the last time I did it and see what's changed. It's not hard, just let's type a command in a terminal and come back in a few hours and see what it's done. So, I don't know, do you do this at all? Do you worry about it at all?
No. But I don't have a large photo collection, really. Yeah. I don't have a large media collection that isn't backed up somewhere else.
Well, I have backups, but if some bits get flipped, you know, Time Machine, for instance, will say, oh, that file's been modified, and then copy the now broken file out there and then age out the old one. So it can be hard to recover. That's why you kind of have to detect it on the fly. That's one of the things that the Hacker News comments people were asking, and it's unknown if that's going to be the case or not, but there's no mention in this APFS about built-in checksumming. It'd be nice if that was the case. So, you know, all of the, not all, Linux is out there forging ahead, of course, but, you know, Windows is still running on NTFS, which is not new anymore. I mean, that's at least 20 years old.
Well, and there was a pretty famous failure on Microsoft's behalf to try and introduce a new file system.
Yeah, WinFS or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then
I think that was in, wasn't that in like Windows 2000 time frame, I think.
Yeah.
And it just never happened. I mean, it was something that was touted. It was a big, because I think that's the thing that I guess is interesting to me. I think it's a sign of forward thinking. It's a sign of continued investment in an operating system to say we've reached the point, you know, where we're at the limits of this current file system. The file system is what the entire thing is built upon, and we're going to start over.
File system doesn't sell. Right?
Right.
Nobody cares.
Exactly.
I care. You care. The five people listening to this podcast might care. But nobody cares. Most of my friends, if I said, oh, there's going to be a new file system on macOS, they'd be like, what is a file system? Do I have one of those? Yes. Well, what's wrong with the one I got now?
Right.
It stores all my files and it gives them back to me when I want. They don't know. They don't care.
So I feel like that's encouraging on like a feel-good, you know, Apple isn't going down the tubes level.
I don't feel like Apple's going down the tubes.
I don't feel that either, but... Or that they don't care about the PC anymore. That they don't care about macOS. If they didn't care about
they would not.
Little M macOS, they wouldn't be rolling out a new file system.
That's true.
So...
So that you are absolutely correct there. They kind of had to be backed into a corner, though. My guess is, you know, whatever engineers they have working on HFS Plus, you know, they said, well, now we need to implement these things. And they must have just said, no, cannot be done. Right?
It's quite possible, too. It has to do with like cross-platform features, something with continuity, something with iCloud, something with syncing, you know.
Yeah, or whatever they've got on the drawing board, right? They must, you know. They've probably come to a point where they recognize, oh man, we're really not going to be able to make this thing work, are we?
Right.
No. I told you 5 years ago you should fix this problem. Now we're finally fixing this problem, right? Because it's got to be expensive. I mean, you probably got to have a team of 100 people for years work on that thing. So it is clearly not the cheapest thing you could do as a development line item. And the payoff of it is close to zero. I mean, at some point when it's probably ready to go, you know, Craig Federighi will stand up on stage at WWDC and say, here's a new file system, and he'll talk about it, and everybody in the audience will clap, and, you know, Syracuse might write a nice article on the web somewhere about it, but no one will care, right? The millions and millions and millions of Apple customers won't care. It'll be 50,000 developers, and that's it. So, but you're right. It is a good sign that Apple appears to be willing to invest at that level.
It makes me laugh. It's funny how Apple does that. It's the last time they really did that big time, I think, is when they switched to 64-bit architecture in iOS, and they touted that at the keynote like it was a huge new feature, you know? And anybody who doesn't work in software was like, huh? I mean, well, did any normal person go, check out this 64-bit operating system on my phone?
Yeah, but they didn't. Did they ever make a commercial that's touted 64-bit?
They never made a commercial.
So. Yeah, no. I mean, but they stood in front of a bunch of developers and said, ha ha, we've got a 64-bit phone, and no one else does, right? So I kind of get that.
So the file system will be the same thing.
It'll be the exact same thing. I suppose if I worked for Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner or something like that, I'd be going, ugh, oh no, what does this mean? Yeah. Or maybe I'd be going, yes, can finally get rid of this HFS Plus crap we've been working on for 15 years.
Now we can sell a new version to everybody else.
Yeah.
That now supports APFS. So that's all I got from WWDC. I, you know, it's interesting, an icon popped up on my Apple TV this morning, I noticed. A big WWDC 2016. And what was interesting is, so I think it remembers the placement of my cursor. So, like, if I walk away from the Apple TV on the home screen, and I come back and I hit, you know, the menu button for it to wake up, the cursor will be in the same position on the same app icon on the home screen.
Why would you expect it to move?
Right. You wouldn't, except this morning when I did that, the WWDC 2016 icon is like in the position where the cursor was left, and then now the cursor is on it. So it's like it was like inserted, and then it was selected.
Do you think you just got lucky?
I don't think so. Like, why would they put it just kind of, it's like in the second, middle of the second row or something like that. Like, anyway, I thought that was interesting. And I didn't go into it. I was on a mission to watch something else before I started work. So I wonder if it'll probably have all the streaming sessions and stuff. Like, I don't think it was just for the keynote. I think it's for all of WWDC. So I might go see.
Yeah, cool.
It'll probably have a terrible interface like everything does. Because I have the old, it's not the brand new Apple TV. It's the last generation. It's pretty hokey. That was a feature, managing your Apple TV accounts and stuff from a computer. So no more arrowing around to type in my email address and my password.
Oh, and they have a new remote app on the phone.
That probably all only applies to the new generation Apple TV, but that might be a reason to get one.
Yeah. Well, and the software might be finished enough now that it's worth doing. Yeah.
I think if... So I've been talking about getting an Amazon Echo, mainly for playing music and podcasts and stuff.
Yeah.
Voice controlled. If they improve the Apple TV such that you could do audio playback with Siri and it worked really well, I'd probably consider getting an Apple TV instead.
So I have an AirPort Extreme. I have an AirPort Extreme, but I also have an AirPort Express. That's the little tiny one. Connected to my stereo, so I can
do it all from your phone.
Yeah, AirPlay is the word I'm looking for. I can AirPlay to it. I should, tomorrow, I'll take some time and I'll ask Siri if she can...
See if you can get that entire workflow of playing something.
Yeah.
Over AirPlay.
Like, play this podcast, you know, over AirPlay to the living room, because that thing is named Living Room.
You know where my money is going to be? No chance in hell.
Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
Okay. Keep me posted.
All right. So we talk about this Everything is a Remix video?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So it's...
So I guess this Everything is a Remix guy, this is a thing, and I didn't really delve into it too much, but he kind of has this course of, like, videos about remixing. And then this Everything is a Remix Force Awakens edition is kind of like an offshoot of his remix agenda.
Yeah, Kirby Ferguson
yeah.
is his name.
So I didn't go watch his other stuff. I would be interested. It seems to be a compelling idea. But this basically was walking through... A little bit of walking through J.J. Abrams' career, showing all the different things he's done that have been, you know, what he calls a remix, or have been somehow, I hate to say a copy, but...
Well, you said, you know, some stuff is copy, some stuff is transform, and some stuff is remix, right?
Right. So he calls out the different things that J.J. Abrams have done, you know, that have been copied, transformative, or remixed. And then he focuses on The Force Awakens.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. My first reaction when I watch this is, well, everything is a copy of something else, or everything is in somehow referential to something else. You know, it's that idea that there's no original thought left. Every song contains some chord progression from some other song. You know, every...
There are those comedians that have that bit where they play the same three chords and sing like a dozen songs to it, right? A dozen popular songs to it.
Yes.
We'll have to dig out that link in the show notes, but you know who I'm talking about though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. I mean, I think a lot of it is kind of a stretch. Like, some of their examples of, like, a scene where there's a sword fight happening in... The Snowfall
yep.
is reminiscent of Kill Bill, well, which was reminiscent of some other movie.
Snow Lady or something.
Yeah. I mean...
It's true.
It is, but so that means forevermore sword fighting in the snow is taken, done. You can't do that without... having stolen it from somewhere else. That's bizarre to me.
No, I don't. He wasn't saying that you can't do it and that it's stolen. What he's suggesting is these people who say, episode 7 is just a retelling of episode 4. What he's saying is, yeah, you friggin' morons, because everything you've ever seen is a retelling of everything else you've ever seen. That's what the point of this whole thing. I don't think he was saying that it's a remix and it's bad. I think he's saying it's a remix because everything is a remix, right? I mean, you break a story down to its basic elements, you've seen it somewhere before, right?
Right.
So, I don't know. I thought he was kind of defending The Force Awakens. I feel
like he is too, but for some reason still those comparisons bother me because it's like, I feel like it's like... it's like Facebook trying to trademark the word face. It's like, you know, well, we used it, so it's ours.
Yeah.
So I feel like drawing those parallels is somehow saying that, you know, it's not his. It's not J.J. Abrams' scene because Quentin Tarantino already did it. I just feel like that was a real stretch. I do think when he gets into, like, the very... He does kind of like point by point comparisons of what was the same between New Hope and Force Awakens. It's very obvious that it was all intentional because you couldn't just kind of accidentally.
No.
You know, it isn't just like it wasn't this big mistake. It wasn't, you know, somebody got drunk and. the next day needed the script and they were hungover and they just like plagiarized it. Like, I mean, it was very intentional. It was
an intentional choice.
That we're rebooting the franchise.
Yeah.
We're drawing all of these distinct parallels with episode 4.
Yes, an old Jedi must be found, right?
There's a new person trying to find them, and then they get trained, and then they encounter the bad guy, and the bad guy kills the old Jedi, and you get to witness it, and yada, yada, yada.
I have to say, too, he talked a little bit about other movies like Jurassic World and other movies that are basically remakes or remixes of past storylines. And I have a hard time with the criticism of that, because why is it so wrong to make a movie that is entertaining and people want to watch?
It's not.
Like, nobody tried to give an Oscar to Jurassic World. Nobody tried to give an Oscar to Force Awakens. I mean, I think it's okay to recognize that maybe it isn't original. Maybe it doesn't deserve, you know, artistic accolades. But I don't have any problem with...
Well, he made the point about, you know, some stuff is familiar and some stuff is novel. But there's actually, there's like a spot in the middle where you kind of get both, right? Mm-hmm. And he didn't talk about it in his video, but in my mind, what I thought of was the movie Her with... Scarlett Johansson and
Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin, yeah. you know, so that movie was novel. The story was novel from its setting of, you know, it's slightly in the future, and there's this, you know, sensitive, lonely guy, but he installs an artificially intelligent operating system on his computer, and he... you know, falls in love with this, you know, brilliant, intelligent being in the computer who just happens to have a very sultry voice, right? But then, you know, so that is novel, right? But the thing that's familiar is it's a love story where one person loves the other one very deeply, but the other person... doesn't, you know, fall in love the same way back, right? And it's like every, you know, teen romance ever. And that's the very familiar part, right? Like, you can, when you're watching that story, it's kind of like a slow motion train wreck, right? Like, you know where it's going, and it goes right where you knew it was going to go, because it's familiar, right? And it's sad and tragic and beautiful all at the same time. So, it, you know, that movie is what I thought of when I watched this. You know, everything is a remix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some stuff is familiar. Some stuff is novel, right? And you can make your novel things more familiar to your audience and therefore more accessible. And... hopefully end up with a hit. It could be that maybe what the criticisms wrapped up around The Force Awakens are is that it was maybe a little too much of that.
I think it's a lot of actual plot being the same, the actual narrative being the same, as opposed to similar themes, similar emotions, similar, you know.
Disney spent a lot of money buying that crap from Lucas.
Yeah.
They took a very safe choice because they need that thing to make money. And it made money. And it looks like it's going to be an outright money printing machine. So maybe what that means is that episode 8 is going to have the more free range to vary more from the set script, right?
I hope so. And I feel like the fact that, you know, after watching this video and talking about it before, it's obvious that the remixing was very intentional, and I think that that is to set up moving in the new direction in the next movie.
Yeah, well, it successfully introduced some characters that you actually like.
Yeah.
And almost no characters that you don't. And can you think of it, somebody in there that you didn't like? Not because they're the bad guy and you don't like the bad guys, but just...
There's a bad...
There's no Jar Jar
yeah.
in the movie.
No, I mean, I wasn't in love with Maz.
No.
I don't know if she's going to continue.
I didn't dislike her.
I didn't. I just, you know, I like the actress who played her so much, and I feel like she was so obscured by the, by the character. I don't know.
They needed a Yoda character right. to impart some exactly. wisdom from an ancient person, and Yoda's already taken.
Yeah. I guess I get that. So I guess my problem is... You're right. He does say it's okay. It's a remix. But before he said that, he said, look at all these things that were copied. So I feel like to haters who are like, it's just a copy, they're going to be like, see, see, yeah. you just said so.
Well, and it's, so. You know, he was pointing out it, you weren't wrong.
Right.
It is the same, but yeah.
He talked about a lot of other interesting movies too, that are very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting yeah. find.
Should we talk about this how do you know when to cut video?
Sure, yeah. I watched that quite a while ago. A
couple weeks now.
Yeah. But then we can get a link in the...
Yeah.
Notes.
And so the... you know, it's just this video explaining from one... person's perspective, when is it that you make an edit? Like, when do you cut when you're, you know, making a movie or a TV show? I mean, you see edits all the time and you don't even really think about it. They showed some examples of, you know, when there's a cut and you almost don't even notice. Like, they almost have to point it out to you. When two people are sitting, you know, and they're talking back and forth, who's ever talking is on the screen, and they just cut back and forth, right? And you can just see it. Or when two people are sitting, and then one person stands up and moves around the room a little bit, they'll often cut so that you can continue to see their face, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of editing you do just, it's almost natural. You don't even see it. But there's some other types of editing that you can do, other times when you can make a cut to change the pacing of a scene that can let the scene develop in a way that it might not have otherwise gone. You know, so you can use editing to make the audience see what the character is looking at, right? And they had some Michael Caine movie where they were showing that, right? They, you know, there's things going on in the room, but what you're seeing based on how they're cut is what he's looking at, right? You can watch his eyes go and look, and then you see what he's looking at, right? And you realize he's looking at that, not what's going on elsewhere in the room. Or you can let, you know, the camera linger on something a little longer than maybe seems natural or right. But if a person's having an emotion, you know, it can almost start to make you feel uncomfortable. But if the character is themselves uncomfortable, maybe that's the right thing. Or if they're, you know, very agitated, right? If it's a bunch of quick cuts, right, you can get their sense of their agitation. But then the kind of the coolest thing they talked about was how, like, they compared and contrasted a scene from Ant-Man where he's trying to learn to control the ants, and the Empire Strikes Back where Luke is trying to levitate the the X-Wing out of the swamp. And it comes down to, as a viewer, your emotions from what you're seeing need some time to build. And so the example from Star Wars was used as a example of this is what you should do, right? Mm-hmm. Times all of the time you get and all of the edits you get to see him starting to raise it up, and you can see Yoda's face and Yoda's saying, oh, wow, maybe you're going to get it, right? And R2-D2 is getting excited and it's starting to come up, and then, you know, that takes a long time, and you have time as a viewer to build up this emotion to, mm-hmm. oh, Luke's going to do it.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And then he doesn't, right? And you have even more time.
A long, slow
right.
fall.
And you get to really feel
the disappointment.
The disappointment and the frustration and the missed opportunity. Mm-hmm. But you have to commit to it, right? Like, that whole scene takes a couple of minutes, which, you know, is harder to do. It takes you that amount of time as a viewer to have those emotions, but you know, some movies, some editors, some directors want to get away from this touchy-feely stuff, and they don't give you the time to experience the emotion in that,
you know. So that was the thing in Ant-Man, like he tries and he fails, and it all happens in the space of
like 2 seconds, right? Or something, right? Yeah. And it's like, oh, you don't feel any emotion for that because you're not given time to feel the emotion. So, it was 6 or 8 minutes video. It was brilliant.
It was very interesting.
It really lets you see more in a movie. It's like when you're watching a movie and you're like, there's just something not quite right about it.
Well, yeah.
Could be because of some of the stuff they talked about in here. I don't know. I found it fascinating to learn about something that I waste so much time in my life doing,
yeah.
Watching movies.
I wonder if part of what drives editing things together so much faster is, I guess, people's attention span, but also just trying to cover so much ground in movies. That's something I've been complaining about lately, that a lot of these Marvel and X-Men and these superhero
Superman
movies that are just trying
Batman.
To do so much. I mean, you look at a movie like Empire and you look at, like, the scope of the story, you know, it's just, it's so much less ground they're trying to cover than modern action movies.
Yeah.
So it's like they have time to take their time. I don't know. I mean, if you lingered a couple extra seconds on every shot in, you know, X-Men Apocalypse, the movie would be 4 hours long.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and it isn't that you need it, but when you're having a pivotal moment, right, when the character is going to succeed or fail at something important, right, like Luke trying to get the X-Wing out of the swamp. Like, that whole sequence is important because, you know, it shows, it makes you understand that Luke is not yet a Jedi, and that he's frustrated, but it lets you know when Yoda does it that Yoda is the real mm-hmm. deal, right? You know, even though he's 900 years old and a short little green dude, he commanded the Force and raised that whole thing right up out of there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those things are important for character development, right? How much emotion do you need when they're fighting with the lightsabers, right? Well, you know, because you had all that time to do the setup, you know that Luke is more or less ill-prepared to face Vader. And so, you know, it's not like we need a flashback in the middle of their lightsaber duel, right? I just need the action of the lightsaber duel. So it's important and relevant at key moments. Mm-hmm. Not all movies are great at recognizing what those key moments are. Sometimes they do. Captain America Civil War seemed to be seem to do a pretty good job at taking the time they needed to help you understand the two different sides, right? Essentially, Tony Stark and Captain America's two different sides to this argument. Like, I didn't feel like I was cheated out of either one of those. But Batman versus Superman, or even the X-Men Apocalypse movie, kind of like, ugh. Why? But, yeah. Anything else?
Nope. I'm good. That was a good find, too. That was a cool video.
Okay. Until next week. See ya.
Good night.